Hey, and welcome to The Unwind, where we talk all things tech and video games. I'm your favorite Windows fanboy, Rob Steller.
And I'm Josiah Hills, and I'm standing up this whole episode.
And I'm Sean Thomas, and we're going to be talking about what Josiah's legs feel like now that he's been standing for a long time.
Did you get a haircut? I think that's what everybody wants to know.
No.
Or are you just hiding it?
I'm just hiding it. Yeah, actually, it's just...
Yeah, it's falling under its own weight now. It's like a beginnings of a black hole.
So, besides the interesting life and times of my hair, this week there were a number of announcements. So I guess we'll just go in chronological order to a degree. We'll start with the Surface event on Monday. So on Monday, Microsoft announced a update to their tablet hybrid lineup, the Surface lineup. So they released the Surface 2, which is essentially the new Surface RT, and then they also released the Surface Pro 2, which is the next Surface Pro. So what do you guys think?
So I think we ended last show with what I wanted to see in these new devices, right?
Yep.
I don't remember exactly what I said, but
it's all a blur.
I do remember. I mean, it had Haswell, which we know, right? We already knew about that, so it's going to get a little bit better battery life. Not significant. I think they said 75% better, something like that.
Yep.
So maybe we're talking 5 hours. Maybe, I don't know. We'll see.
I don't know. I think you can get close to 8. If you have the battery cover.
Oh yeah, I didn't get there yet.
Yeah. Okay.
I was just how it is right now.
Well, how much battery left did the first one have?
I mean, I get like maybe 3-4. So
well,
we're talking.
Let's just say 4 hours. So
okay, so that's 2.
That 3 hours.
3 hours, yeah.
So add 3 hours, so you'd have 7 hours.
I don't know. I'm very skeptical.
I'm just saying, like, if it's 75% increase, it's not going to be 5 hours. It'll be a lot more than that.
No, but we'll see. It does have, well, there is a version of the Surface Pro 2 with 8 gigs of RAM, which is what I wanted. However, it comes at a pretty significantly steep price increase. So the Surface Pro 2 is starting at $899, which is, I'm pretty sure, what they started at last time around. That's with 64 gigs of hard drive space, which is really not that much for a laptop sort of replacement.
Yeah, it's 64 with Windows 8 on it. So
yeah, so you're talking about like 30 something. So we got $999 for the Pro with Pro 2 with 128, and then if you want 8 gigs of RAM, you need to go $1,300, which is, it kind of broke my heart because I kind of wanted that, but now I have to seriously think of whether that's worth $300. You know, if I'm not going to be playing games or doing video editing or things like that on this. And then they have the 512 gig hard drive Pro 2 for $1,800, which is kind of absurd. I mean, you're talking about, like, you know, Mac Pro prices.
Yeah, Mac Pro is, definitely, which is going to have a bigger screen and it's going to have the Retina screen.
And, right. So that's a little ridiculous. Yeah. I don't know who's going to buy those devices. However, so they announced a bunch of new. Unless you guys have anything to comment about that, about the pricing.
Yeah, I think the pricing is still a little bit
it
off.
It would have been nice to see $100 less from what they went last year. Although, yeah. So the RT, or the new RT, the Surface 2, is starting at $449 for the 32 gig one, which is cheaper than where they started at last time around.
You know, it's a better price, and the hardware, I think, is pretty cool. But I still don't have any faith in Windows RT. I mean, I forget who it was who said this, but some Microsoft executive just recently was saying he agreed that there shouldn't be two operating systems that work on ARM. So that means what? They're going to get rid of RT, or they're going to combine RT with Windows Phone, or, you know, RT is definitely the weaker of the two, so it stands to reason that they'd get rid of RT. So it's kind of like buying a Saturn right now. You know, they don't make Saturns anymore, so why would you ever buy one? Sorry.
John?
Yeah, I don't know. The RT line is still interesting. I don't know if they have some kind of other long play for it. I don't know what they're going to do. I mean, yeah, I can only think of them doing something where they're combining Windows Phone or some kind of... I don't know what they're going to do.
Actually, I'm pretty sure I just read today that they're going to be unifying the marketplace for Windows and Windows Phone for the store.
So just the marketplace or... Okay.
But then, even then, I don't know if that matters that much, in that this then it gets into the same problem that Android had, where it's like, do you really want to use phone apps on a bigger screen? Like, Android, for a while, the problem is they didn't have any tablet apps.
I mean, the problem is still you don't even have apps for for the tablet or the phone version.
Ostensibly, by adding Windows 8 Phone 8 support, you'd be getting more apps. I assume that Windows Phone 8 has far more apps than Windows RT does. I haven't even seen the apps for Windows RT, but I can't imagine that there's that many. But I think it'd still be pretty useful as a if you don't need that app support, which I really think, I mean, there's more people than you would think.
You still just get Office. You get all apps on it, too, which is nice.
And maybe, I don't know, $4.49 maybe, but like if you think about the original RT, the problem is the original RT isn't as fast. But like if you can get it at the $300 range, I mean, you know, that's why you could definitely get that over a Chromebook. And it's really just, battery life. You need the battery life to be better.
It's a really portable and relatively cheap productivity machine. Right, so because if you buy the cover, the type cover, right, so you got what, that's going to be $500.
Yeah.
You've got full Office, Outlook, and, you know, it used to be a time when just Office by itself would cost you, what, $300?
Yeah. Right?
So
still
you get
does,
a tablet.
Doesn't it? I mean, if you don't get the...
I think it's Office 365 is $99 a year for the home office version. So anyhow, you know, it's relatively cheap when you throw that in there, but they're talking about, they've got the web apps that you can use on other tablets, both Android and iOS tablets. And then on top of that, they're talking about releasing Office on Android and iOS. So, you know, even that edge, because of market pressure, they can't keep that edge. It's a really nice edge to have, but they know they can't keep that edge forever. So it's just, it's, you know, if you want a cheap productivity machine, that's a good solution. But if you're thinking about the long game, it's too risky. It's too much of a gamble.
And I think the key is that I don't think there's anything that makes you say, this is why I would definitely get this over any other device. Like, I would say if you don't want an iPad and you don't want an Android, it's not like you're going to have a huge problem.
Right.
You don't care about apps, but it's definitely not a differentiator.
Yeah, they have that turn-in program that you can exchange your iPad.
Yeah, you get $200 bucks, right?
Yeah, and it's funny because what people started asking was, well, can I trade in my old Surface RT for a new one? And they're like, no.
Yeah, but I mean, if you had an iPad 2, right, that you've had for a few years now, and you got, I don't know if they give you $200 for every device or just certain ones. Do you know how that works?
Yeah, I didn't look at the details. I think it's $200 up to $300, so I think they do differentiate.
But, I mean, if you had an iPad 2 kicking around for a while, I mean, then you get a new Surface for $250. That's pretty good.
Yes and no. So, no, I'm not even trying to be funny. If I've had an iPad 2 since the iPad 2 came out, right, chances are I know a good number of apps that I've grown very accustomed to. And, you know, because I've had that, that means I've had that iPad 2 for 3 to 4 years almost. So chances are there are many apps that I have on the iPad 2 that I can't get on the Surface. So,
but Office,
it doesn't quite make sense to me still.
Office, man. And maybe you really hate iOS 7. You're like, I hate this so much, I'm going to Windows.
You know, it's funny. I've heard a lot of people that, like, over Twitter and Facebook and stuff, who just hated iOS 7. But I, like, it's kind of the thing that Josiah said, where they're like, oh, you know, after a few days, they just kind of get used to it, and then it's just whatever.
I heard
I don't think anybody's going to switch their phone, let me put it that way.
Nah.
I heard one weird issue with iOS 7 was that people were getting motion sickness because the animations are slowed down, so they're more pronounced, and people would actually have trouble with the fly-in things, which I think is hilarious.
You know what I heard? I had two people comment to me today that iOS 7 looked like Windows Phone. And I have no idea what they, like, how they came to that conclusion.
I don't know.
The color schemes are all off. Maybe they're colorblind. That's fine.
I think it's just because they're so used to looking at iOS. If they see anything else, they're like, oh, this must be Windows. Cause
what kind of iPhone is that?
But anyway, the other announcements from the Surface presentation, they announced that there will be new keyboards or updates to their keyboards. So there's the new Type and Touch cover that are now 1 millimeter thinner than they were this time around, if they weren't thin enough. But they're both going to be backlit, which is kind of cool. And probably,
even the Touch is backlit?
I think so, yeah.
Wow.
That's pretty slick. They also came out with their Remix Music Blade, I guess it's called, right? Which is a cool idea.
It's a cool idea, but like
if you're talking about if you're talking about another $100, you have to. Plus, you know, most DJs I've seen are on Apple devices anyway, so you know, you'd have to convince them and get the app support to Remix. But anyway, they also talked about docking station that they're releasing for $199. That's pretty typical to any docking station.
Yeah,
and then a power cover, which is very interesting. I don't know if they released a firm cost to it. I think it's $199.
Oof.
But it's supposed to double, I think, the battery life, or add another 6 hours, 7 hours, something like that. So, it is a little bit thicker though. It is a little bit thicker than the Type.
Sure. Cover. So that power cover, it sounds expensive, but if you can break it down, you think about what's an extra battery cost for a laptop that's going to be like $90, right? About that. And then you throw in $90 plus the touch cover, the Type cover, sorry, and it comes out to about $200. So in theory, I mean, if you break it down that way, it makes sense to get to that $200 price range, but a lot of people are going to just look at it like, $200 for a keyboard? That's crazy.
Yeah, that's a lot of money, I think. I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see how well it does when it actually comes out, and how much battery life it extends it to, and how thick it actually is, and things like that.
Right. But the other thing is, you know, you're getting into the range of some of these other Windows 8 laptops that have, you know, like the Yoga. You know, kind of alternative form factors, you know, because it's going to be heavier, it's going to be costlier, and you get better battery life, but you get better battery life out of a regular tablet anyway. So it's going to be interesting to see how it does compete against those other kind of hybrid laptops out there for the Windows 8 community.
So, yeah, gotcha.
We talked about the specifics of all of this, but, you know, the real question is, you know, whether or not this is good enough to bring them where they need to be. So how much has it changed? What's happening with that? And one thing I wanted to mention with the power cover and stuff like that, I noticed in part of, I didn't watch the whole thing, but I watched part of the keynote, and in it, he made a big point of how powerful the processor was, how powerful the Surface Pro itself was, which is interesting because, I don't know, I feel like Apple did the whole spec thing too as well, where they're talking about 64-bit processors and stuff. I was just surprised that specs were a big thing. But he kept trying to mention that, and he used an example of hooking up a RED camera, you know, RED, the extremely high HD, like they were using 6K film, and he could like flip through really quickly. And he was just mentioning the power. And one point he mentions, he goes, you know, we could have throttled the processor to some extent and gotten some more battery life out of it and kept it cooler to keep it battery life. But we wanted a full powered machine in there. And this is the kind of things where I'm thinking, you know, to me at least, this is, I mean, they're aiming it clearly to be a power machine. Literally, this can do everything. You know, if you're a video editor, if you're a photo editor, whatever, something you need, a CAD designer, you can use this thing. But I'm not so sure people will end up doing it that way. I think it would have been better if they did. I mean, I think CPU speeds have massively leaped the need for CPU. So I think it would have made sense if they had throttled it and you got better battery life that way instead of having to have these other workarounds and things like that. And I don't see people thinking, even with the dock, I don't see people thinking like this is going to be my new full power workstation. Like I feel like people who work at Lucasfilm are still going to be using these giant towers that have like core, you know, Fire GLs in there or something like that to use whatever they need to use. Like I feel like it needs to be powerful enough to use what you need it to use. I think, you know, Excel has to be quick, Word has to be quick, Internet has to be quick, but I don't know. I don't think this play for power is really that.
I think that's a good point, Sean, and that's kind of what I always bring up as a negative against Samsung, and it kind of reminds me of what Craig Federighi said. You know, new is easy, right is hard. And it's all about, you guys know I watch Project Runway, right? So it's all about, you know, Tim Gunn always comes into the workroom and he's like, you got to edit. You got to edit. You got a lot of good stuff here. You're right. It's all good stuff. But all together, it's going to be a shit show. You got to edit. You got to make a tough decision and figure out who you're selling to. So, you know, to that end, it sounds like Microsoft is trying to sell this to the you know, the gearheads and the power crew, but to that end, it's like, okay, am I going to do CAD on an 11-inch screen? It's a beautiful screen, but I'm not going to do CAD on an 11-inch screen, you know?
And so even beyond that, what do you guys think in terms of how the Surface Pro 2 compares to the Surface Pro? We'll set aside RT.
Clearly, I mean, it's... The Pro 2 is an awesome machine. It's a very great, very good evolution of the Surface Pro. You know, I wouldn't say it's revolutionary. The Pro was revolutionary in its form factor and what Microsoft was trying to do, and I think they did a very good job with the Surface Pro 2. But like I said earlier, I feel like the cost, it's just a little bit too premium. There's still a question mark hanging over it.
Yeah, I would have definitely liked to see starting at $899 instead of $999.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if they had gone with $1,000, including the cover, or, you know, I mean, if you bought one of the higher end, or if you brought a Surface Pro 2, I think it should have come with one of the two covers.
Right, because, you know, Rob and I, we always compare it to the 11-inch MacBook Air, right? And so... yeah, it does have the touch screen that the MacBook Air doesn't have, but otherwise it's not as competitive on price, ironically.
You know, I'm going to be a little harsher. I think Windows 8 is, you know, the biggest change Microsoft has had in probably its whole history. So this is like a cornerstone element of their whole play. They need to get this right, and they were doing poorly, and I don't feel like this changes... I like even the littlest thing, like, you know, a lot of times you'll see the iPad and there's a spec bump, like iPad 1 to 2 is a lot of spec bump, but they'll even add like something, like it'll be rounded edges, like even some slight difference to make it feel like, oh, I have the iPad 2, not the iPad 1. I feel like...
Wait, actually, they replaced...
Hold on.
On the kickstand in the back, now you have two options for the kickstand angle, and... To top it off, instead of the Windows logo, it says Surface on the back.
Which actually, both of which I like. I like seeing Surface on the back. I think it, I don't know, it's a cool name in a weird way. I don't know, I like it. And the kickstand, yeah, I don't know how we missed that. That was like one of the big things. And actually, in the part of the keynote, he specifically pointed out, so he said that he was 5'8", and he said the regular kickstand works perfectly for someone who's 5'8", maybe up to 5'10", but if you're taller than that, you know, it just becomes an issue. And so they have two, it's a two-stage kickstand, so you can push it out even further and it'll be a little flatter, so you can do it. And they also mentioned that he said it was really hard to use in the lap. I don't know, but and then he said this made it a lot better to use in the lap, which is pretty big. That's big. But I just feel when the iPad was dominant, Google felt like we got to get into this market. So they released with Motorola the Zoom. It was a failure. Nobody wanted it. Everybody started making Android devices, like whatever, Asus, all these other things. None of them worked. So how did they get in? They made something that was super cheap and in a different form factor. They came out with the Nexus 7, and it worked really, really well. And obviously, you know, now it's, I mean, they actually got their foot in the door. And now they're actually a significant part. Amazon made their whole thing. And there's something like, there has to be some kind of differentiator. Even cutting $100 off, like, yeah, it looks nice, but how do you get people who don't want this to want it all of a sudden? Like, it's tough. And they've already, like, it's not like they can just universally change the system. And I think there are a lot of people who just don't like that idea. But, you know, this is a really big deal for Microsoft. They did say in the keynote, in the part that I saw, that they said, this is one of those, you know, they're not giving out numbers, so you don't know what they're talking about. But he said they were selling extremely well for their class, the Surface Pro 2, the Surface Pro. And he's like, not a lot of people know this, but it's selling really well for its class. I don't know what that means, because I don't know what they
11
say
inch
the class is.
Laptops?
Yeah, is it 11-inch
11 inch Windows laptops? How many of those
Windows
are
tablets, which exist one.
But is that? I don't know. Are they doing laptops or are they doing tablets? Like, I don't know. But my point is, like, this is such a... This whole thing... I know. I think this... These things could lead to a bigger shift overall. Like, I think this... The problem is, you know, we talk about iOS 7 and we say, you know, people are just going to get used to it. It's not like they're going to switch away from it. The problem is, I personally think there is a bigger likelihood that there's going to be people who will say, I don't want Windows 8. I'm going to shift to an OS X device. And I think it's getting kind of scary in that so many people, an insane amount of people I know have MacBooks, people who would not even think about Apple 5-10 years ago. And all these people, I mean, they're just going to grow up. They're probably going to give their kids when they have kids. Like, you know, it starts that cycle of that. So I don't know. I think, I mean, this is all a critical time for them. So
That's a good point. You know, to draw a distinction, you know, so iOS is a free operating system. Right, I mean, you need the device, but the upgrades have always been free unless you're on an iPod Touch. So Windows, I mean, it's a huge investment, so people definitely do pause before upgrading Windows. And the average consumer is going to never buy a new copy of Windows. They're going to buy a new PC. Okay. So, you know, that choice that you're talking about of, do I upgrade to Windows 8... or do I buy a MacBook or something like that? I think you bring up a good point, but I think it exists mostly for PCs because of the way you upgrade a PC. You know, like for IT, for enterprise, that's not an issue. They're going to upgrade Windows, and they're going to do it probably 3 to 4 years after it's been released. You know, so.
But enterprise is interesting too, because I think I feel like there's more of a shift of bring your own device, which is making it interesting.
Yeah.
There's still, I mean, it's not like enterprise is gone. There's still definitely many people get their company laptop and things like that, but there are more and more people who are bringing their own device, which could signal that shift. And one big thing, I mean, well, two things I will say that would stem this shift is obviously price. I mean, I think I'm surprised how many people will, like, I know a lot of people who will buy like a $1,200 MacBook Air, but wouldn't have spent $1,200 on a Windows PC. I'm surprised they spend that much money. But but you know, Apple doesn't have a low end. So for the people who want to buy a $500 to $700 laptop, unless you buy an old one, And the other thing is, I don't know much about the international market at all. Most of my experience is anecdotal, but I know in America, Apple's gotten a stronger foothold. Definitely the iPhone abroad has done well, but I'm not certain that the other lines of computers have been as successful in other countries.
I mean, I wouldn't say Mac is dominant in any country,
still,
but I mean, it has a strong foothold in the places you'd expect, basically relatively wealthy and educated countries. So France.
What are you trying to say?
No. Yeah, first world countries. First world countries. So France, Japan, you know, Great Britain,
yeah.
It's okay there. But it's not dominant in any country. But your BYOD argument leads us into another story, if I can make a transition. So BYOD kind of was the beginnings of the end for BlackBerry. And recently this week, BlackBerry announced that they have a tentative deal to sell to Fairfax Financial, which is
they got money.
What do you call it? Yeah, it's one of those, the term escapes me. It's one of those companies that buy other companies and then flip them.
Oh, like an equity firm?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. So, like Bain Capital and stuff like that. So, they have this tentative deal. I think it's, what, $4.7 billion or something around there. And some people are speculating that it's kind of a way for them to bump up the price of BlackBerry stock, because they're not a majority holder, but they have a huge stake in it, I think in the tens of percent, so either like 10, 15, 20% around there. And so they are purchasing, so they got that price of $4-something billion dollars based off of a $9 stock price.
Okay.
So, and I think they said they're going to hold their offer for, I think, like 6 weeks or something like that. So if BlackBerry can sell to somebody else, they will have to pay out to Fairfield Financial, and presumably it'd be at a higher stock price. So some people are saying, you know, this is just kind of a ploy by them to raise the price. Mm-hmm. And they feel like $4 billion is a good enough price that they could chop it up, sell the patents and stuff like that, and make their money back day one, pretty much, after they buy it. But what they're really trying to do is raise the stock price, have somebody else buy it from, and you know, buy it at a higher stock price, and then sell their shares of stock, because I think they bought it at almost double of what it is now. So.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I wonder who the buyers are going to be. I mean, if you think about all the divisions, like. One big thing could be patents. In tech, patents are a very big deal. Although, you can bring a parallel to Google buying Motorola. They always harped on, oh, we bought them for the patents. That did not lead to anything. I mean, they really haven't made much money at all.
Well, so it's not always buying patents to make money off of it. It's buying patents to protect yourself, because it's kind of like, okay, you're not gonna. It's, you know, it's mutual assured destruction. It's like the Cold War. It's like, okay, well, I'm not gonna bomb you because you got bombs. Well, I'm not gonna sue you because you can sue equally bad. So.
Well, that's a question. I don't know enough about it, but I wonder how many patents that BlackBerry have. I mean, I'm sure they have some valuable patents, but there's one end of it. I don't know, the devices division and stuff, their hardware, I don't know, I'm not sure. I wonder if, like, does somebody want to revive the brand? I had heard that Lazaridis wanted to buy it back, or help him buy, like, raise capital, and that's one thing he was trying to do. I don't know. I
don't think they have a future in hardware anymore, manufacturing. I mean, you can sell off the actual machines, right? Not the BlackBerry devices, but they used to manufacture their own devices. So you can sell off those factories. That's still valuable equipment and stuff like that. But I don't see anybody, you know, after this year or by the middle of next year, I don't see anybody being able to buy anything with BlackBerry 10 on it.
You know, it's funny. You see, I mean, in just this month, you see BlackBerry and Nokia pretty much gone. I mean, this has been slow decline, but this is like the official.
Yep.
Now it's really happening.
Yep.
And you know, they both had their heyday in the 90s, and it's crazy how much the landscape has changed. And you think, like, in the future, like, it's going to be hilarious if in not hilarious, but crazy if in 10 years you're all of a sudden saying Google and, you know, Apple are bought out by XYZ company.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's funny, though, it makes me also realize how resilient Microsoft is. Because Microsoft is still making insane money. And their heyday was in the 90s as well. And they are still doing extremely well. I mean, they're losing in certain ways, but clearly they're still a very profitable company. They're still doing very well in many ways. And I don't know, you point to, I don't know, I see that as a very positive thing. And
yeah, I agree with that analysis. I mean, Nokia, BlackBerry, they were kind of one-trick ponies, and they didn't start changing fast enough. Microsoft has a much broader base, and people are freaking out because they're not in the game as much as they want them to be, but they're still getting into the game, and you know, it's a slow start, but it's not going to be like an HP. They put out a tablet and pull it off the markets within 2 months and then sell that, you know. So
yeah, Palm OS.
I feel like from that standpoint, Microsoft realizes that there's no pulling out of this. They got to see it to the finish. They might change their strategy along the way, but they can't not just decide to not try to make tablets anymore or mobile devices anymore. They realize they have to go in.
Sure.
With that said, I don't know if they're going to be totally invested in specifically RT. But yeah, it is kind of crazy just to see Nokia and BlackBerry just fall so far so quickly. And but I think Microsoft is a special case that they won't fall that quickly. They still have a lot of time, but it is starting to get to be urgent, or a little post-urgent, I'd say. So anyhow, anything else on BlackBerry?
No, let's
pour out a little bit of liquor for him.
Let's stay with phones, though. So Josiah, you got the iPhone 5S, right?
Well, yeah.
Before you go off on your rant, let's just talk about the 5S for a minute.
I got two 5S's. Anybody want it?
We are going to give away. No, I'm just kidding.
No giveaways, you know, but you can buy them for full price.
My sister needed a new phone. She's on a 3GS, and she was using my Lumia 800 for a while. But anyway, she wasn't going to get the 5S. She was going to get the 5. But she ended up going to the AT&T store, which, you know, now is the worst time to go to the AT&T store.
Yeah.
There's going to be tons of kids. And she's in Boston, so, you know, it's a city, so maybe it'll be more populated. She ended up trying to upgrade her phone, and she got kicked out because the line was too long, so they, like, cut it off or something like that. I'm like, yeah, you should probably
What was she thinking?
Although, I don't know what'll happen because she doesn't really want the 5C. She doesn't really care for the colors, and she doesn't want plastic. But I have no idea how long the 5 stock lasts. I don't know what they do with that.
Probably best thing for her is probably buy it used. But
she would get it new. She gets very frustrated with things, so she doesn't want something.
Okay.
I wonder if she could order it online though. I never thought about that.
I don't know if it's still available to order online. You might be able to find it from. Like, I don't think you can order from Apple online anymore.
That would make sense. I mean, anyway.
Maybe check their refurbished store. But anyhow, so I got the 5S, one for my wife, one for myself. It's an awesome phone. For me, it's just right. So, and again, so I'll explain why it's just right for me, but I realize it might not be right for everybody. Earlier in the summer, when Rob and I were talking, I said, you probably remember this, Rob. I said I wasn't going to buy a new iPhone unless it had one of two things, a fingerprint reader or a bigger screen, right? And so I got the chance to demo a Samsung Galaxy S4 over the summer, and I said, wow, this screen is amazing, but it's way too big for me to hold this phone and use it with one hand. So I got the iPhone 5S, and the screen is just right. I think it you know, and that's what Steve Jobs said when they released the 5, is that you know, you can use it with one hand, and so that holds true. You know, I don't have giant basketball player hands, so it's just the right size for me. And that fingerprint reader is amazing. You tap the home button and let rest your finger there, and it unlocks. So I would do that, and by the time I pulled it out of my pocket and had it in front of my face, unlocked. So pretty awesome.
That's pretty quick.
Very, sure. Yeah. It just really changes the way that I use and interact with my phone. I know that people are talking about, oh, it's been hacked, it's not secure. But, I mean, when you look at the number of people who don't bother to lock their screens at all, Marissa Meyer admitting that she's one of them, you know, I think the implementation of a fingerprint reader is a good compromise, number one, and because to use the fingerprint reader, you have to put in a passcode. So for non-security-minded people, it forces them to be slightly more secure.
Oh, you have to use it to unlock the phone?
No, if you choose to enable fingerprint reading,
okay.
Touch ID, then you have to put in a passcode.
Gotcha. Right?
Because if it misreads a number of times, I think like 5 or more times, it will stop using the scanner, the Touch ID, and you have to type in your passcode. So, and also if the phone restarts, you have to type in your passcode. Like if you turn it off and then turn it back on, you have to use the passcode the first time. So, you know, there's just a little extra security there for people who wouldn't normally think of security because they want to use this new feature. Additionally, for somebody like me that and I'm not a security expert, but I definitely think about security and passcodes, I'm now using, or when I was using the iPhone 5S, and I'll get to that in a second, not using it anymore. It's in the box. It's going to go home, and I'm going to get my money back. But
I'm just going to take that quote. That is your entire review. It's in the box. I'm sending it back.
I was misquoted. It's out of context. But so when I was using it, I actually put in a more complex password because I wouldn't have to type that in every time I wanted to get into my phone.
1, 4, @L.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I use the phone when I drive a lot, and I don't want to have to, if the screen falls asleep and I have to unlock it, I don't want to try to type in this crazy complex passcode while I'm driving. So it lets me have a complex passcode, but I can get the phone open very easily. So that alone, I think, just nails it for me. It's a pretty awesome phone. On top of that, you know, it's got the improved chip. They did some benchmarks. They say it screams. I mean, it's faster than some of the quad-core stuff out there. But, you know, I don't really see the point in that until developers start taking advantage of it. So really the only thing that is somewhat tangible, no pun intended, is that fingerprint reader right out the box.
One thing with the fingerprint reader, there are a lot of talks about it being hacked. I feel like that's a... It's really subjective of whether or not it's hacked.
Well, you know, so the big thing to me is if you're using a password, that can be hacked just as easily. And, you know, if you have people who know what they're doing and you use the default 4-number password, that's going to be hacked in a matter of minutes with anybody. You know, you can have an i7 chip and you can run some scripts that you just get off anywhere site and you can hack that. So to me, the security comes from find my iPhone and remote wipe. So I just need something that keeps the bad guys off my phone long enough for me to realize that my phone is missing and I can go into a computer and do a remote wipe.
Well, what I was going to say is so when I said the hacking thing, I don't even know what that means because I don't think when people steal your phone, I mean, they still have to lift your fingerprint somehow or some way to get in that way, and I don't, unless, it's very unlikely, but unless your fingerprint is, like, perfectly on the actual fingerprint button, and then they can lift it off that way,
yeah.
It seems unlikely that you wouldn't smush it at all, it seems like who's going to have a fingerprint database as yeah. opposed to a password where you pack it. The only thing I will say, because actually, apparently in Germany, I wish maybe if I can find the article, I'll send it. But basically, there was some push in, I believe, Germany to use fingerprint readers for some kind of security.
Right.
And one activist group pointed out that it's bad for only one reason, and I can see this, is that if your fingerprint is hacked or whatever, they lift it, you can't change your finger. You can use a different finger, but right. if they have all your fingers, a password, you can change at any point.
Right.
Now, I think this would only be a problem if, for example, if you're like a head of state, like something important. The likelihood that they're also getting your fingerprints, I don't know. I mean, it just seems unlikely. But and like you said, I mean, most phones have the wiping remote wipe feature, so who knows if this will be a big deal. The only thing I could say is, yeah, I would say a little problem is that you can always change your passcode. You can't change your fingerprint. But
yep. You can change the actual finger that you use, and so you got 10 potentially passwords.
And you gotta I'm gonna start in with this.
People
yeah,
actually,
you know, I think
they've actually
I think
scanned different body parts. I'll just leave it at that. But different body parts do work.
I saw somebody aligning their phone with their nipple because I don't know how it works. But I don't know.
What was that joke, Sean, that you sent us about people tossing their phone in water?
oh, so that was bad. So apparently, the news reports are saying 4chan, but I saw this on Imgur, and Imgur is directly related to Reddit. So they said, hey, let's put out a professional-looking ad that says one of the new features. But they said one of the new features of iOS 7, which is hilarious.
It makes no sense. It makes no
iOS 7 is that it's waterproof. Then a lot of actual publications wrote that people were complaining about it. However, I don't know. I think the publications reported that they saw tweets of people complaining that their phones were destroyed, which could be one of those people who were in on the joke decided to do tweets about it. Like, I don't know if it actually happened. But when I saw that, there were a lot of real, actual good newspapers that were reporting that people had put their phone in water because they thought it was waterproof because of those ads.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
So I need to hurry up and sort your phone situation out so you can give me your old iPhone so I can play Plants vs. Zombies 2.
So let me explain.
You heard it first. Rob's been using an iPhone in a couple weeks. He's over. He just switched. Sorry, Microsoft fans.
So the reason I'm sending the phones back is because I bought the phones for T-Mobile. I've been using AT&T for 4 years since I got my original iPhone 3GS, and obviously with my iPhone 4S. And I was very satisfied with AT&T, as much flack as it used to get. I think it's actually quite good now. I was lured away by the fact that I did the math and I could save a little bit over $300 over 2 years if I had switched to T-Mobile. And I read the coverage maps, I read some reports, and I talked to a couple people that I know who use T-Mobile. And they're like, it's pretty good. And when you don't get good coverage, you can do Wi-Fi calling on the phone, so that's not a problem. They have this system where it automatically switches from whenever you come into a trusted Wi-Fi network, it automatically switches you to VoIP seamlessly. So that sort of thing. So I was like, okay, I think I can do this. I checked the maps, and I commute 60 miles to work every day. So I checked that commute, and the commute was fine, according to the maps. Well, the commute is not fine. For I tested this out, literally almost 15 miles of the first half of my commute, I get data speeds of less than on average. So I use RootMetrics speed test and network test, and they have a mode where you can set it to just keep continuously run for however many minutes you set it to. So I set it to 20 minutes or 10 minutes, and I did it twice. And during that 20-minute stretch, the average download rate was, for I think the first 10 minutes, was like 500 kilobits per second, and which means I can't stream anything from Spotify, I can't stream any podcasts, and
So, and you're not in the middle of nowhere. Like,
no, there are two major highways in Connecticut. That's one of them. And for 15 miles between what is Waterbury is like the fifth biggest city in Connecticut, and Danbury is like the seventh or eighth biggest city in Connecticut. Between those two cities, I can't get any downloads to stream music or to stream podcasts.
Even when you were at my house, you didn't get anything.
Yeah. Yeah, so when it works, it's awesome. I'm like 17, 18, 20 kilobits per megabits per second download. That's great, but and it seemed to be very finicky. Like I'd walk within my house, and I've never had this problem with AT&T, but within my house, I'd walk 20 feet, and it'd go from one bar to three bar to two bar. So I don't understand. So basically, I can't use the phone, and so... So here actually begins my rant, and I'll try to easily block me, shut me up after 3 minutes, because I won't spend.
Go.
But so not happy with the coverage. It's disappointing. Okay, fine. So I know that with this version of the iPhone 5S, they put in all the antennas. So basically, they're selling one phone in all of North America. Right, because it's got the CDMA antennas, it's got the GMS antennas, and it's set. You can use the same phone on Verizon, Sprint, AT&T, or T-Mobile. You just have to unlock it. So I was like, well, you know what? I bought this phone, or I did the down payment, but I'm just going to buy it outright and then have them unlock it and go back to AT&T. So I go to the store, I pay for it. You know, we're talking like $1,200 out of my pocket, just pay for the rest of the phones. And then I was like, great, can you unlock this for me? And they're like, oh, no, we can't do that. You have to call customer service. They'll unlock it for you. And I was like, okay, well, what's the number and how long will that take? Does it take a day? Does it take 2 days? And they're like, oh, it happens immediately. They just put in a request to Apple, and then Apple, then you refresh the phone, you plug it into your iTunes, and it refreshes, and it's done. But we don't unlock phones until you've used our service for 40 days.
Like,
what are you talking about? How is that legal? I own the phones. They are my phones. How can you tell me I can't use a phone for 40 days? It's so bizarre. It's like, well, all right, but... here, you like these jeans? Go ahead and pay for them. By the way, I get to wear them for the first 40 days, not you. I don't understand that.
For a while, though.
What's that?
For a while. So with any carrier, even ones that you buy on plan, a lot of times you can get it unlocked. Like I remember once my sister was going abroad, so she called them up and asked them if they'd unlock it, and they would. However, for a long time, they would not unlock any iPhones for you. They started changing it, I think, once Apple started actually selling unlocked versions.
Yeah.
But I still remember that there were a lot of specifics that they were more hesitant.
Well,
I assume it was an Apple policy, but I don't know.
I don't think it's an Apple policy. I think it's a policy that Apple allowed to happen because it protects the retailers, the carriers. Right, and because the carriers pay huge subsidies, or they pay huge fees to Apple, like the subsidies don't come out of Apple's pockets; they come out of the carriers' pockets.
Yeah.
On top of that, when carriers get to carry the iPhone, they have to lock in to a certain number of purchases. Like they buy a block number of iPhones up front, and if they don't sell them, Apple doesn't care. It's you have to buy these many iPhones. So it's a capital thing for a lot of carriers. Like a lot of the smaller carriers can't afford to sell the iPhone because they can't buy enough iPhones up front because they know they're not going to be able to sell them up front.
But so, even if you, I mean, you'd still have an ETF if you didn't finish paying off the phone and you wanted to get it unlocked, you know what I mean? So what difference would that make? You'd still be paying all the money.
Right.
How would that protect AT&T back when they had the iPhone exclusivity? I guess, I mean, you couldn't go to T-Mobile technically unless you got it unlocked through some other way.
Yeah, you can't leave the carrier until you get it unlocked. It doesn't matter what the intent. So basically, they are going to get a month and a half of my monthly fee to them. no matter what.
I guess that would lock you in.
But, you know, so they, yeah. I already paid them for the phone, so they're not losing any money on the phone, and they're getting an extra month and a half of service from me. So it's BS as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, I called customer service, talked to the first lady, and the first lady, I wish I recorded the call because I swear she was telling me something that's got to be straight up illegal. But so she was telling me, no, it's 40 days, and I was like, well, so I don't understand because I'm not on contract. And she's like, you're right, you're not on contract, but the only way you can have these phones unlocked is if you cancel your contract. And I was like, but I'm not on contract. And she was like, well, if you cancel your plan, you can get the phones unlocked. And I said, well, can I still port my number? And she said, no, you cancel your plan, so the number disappears. I was like, well, that's not acceptable. What else you got for me? And she said, well, you can pay a termination fee. And I was like, but I'm not on contract. I own the phones. And she's like, well, we used to call it a termination fee, so we still call it a termination fee, but it's, you're right, you're not on contract. I'm like, so what's the point of that? Well, how much is the fee? It's $200 per phone.
Oh, my God.
So they're like, you can pay me $400 so I can send this email to Apple to let them know that they can unlock your phone. It's like, you guys are insane. So I'm definitely writing the Better Business Bureau. I'm writing the Attorney General, and I've tweeted the hell out of this, and we've captured it on this show. So T-Mobile, one, it would have been okay if their coverage just didn't work out for me because I know I travel a lot and, you know, they can't be everywhere. But the fact that, you know, they're basically trying to strong-arm me into staying with them for over a month when they know I can't use their service is totally BS. It's ridiculous. So, so yeah. So I have to send these iPhones back. Even though I think they're a great product, I have to send them back, and I've ordered new iPhones for AT&T. I went back to my old plan, but because they're sold out, I will get them in maybe 4 weeks.
Oh, that sucks.
You know, it's not the end of the world. It's definitely a first world problem, but it's just really frustrating that the way T-Mobile handled this, I think is ridiculous. And when I went to AT&T and I asked, you know, I told the guy, I got to wait 40 days to unlock these phones. Can you unlock them for me? He's like, what are you talking about, 40 days? It's like, I bought these phones from T-Mobile, and they won't unlock them. And he's like, well, that's probably because you're on contract. And I told him, no, I paid for the phones. I paid outright. And he's like, I don't understand that policy. I've never heard of that. So, you know, I didn't ask him to show me his policy at AT&T, but if this guy is telling me, like, he visually flinched when I said, I have to wait 40 days, and he was like, I don't know what you're talking about. So it doesn't sound like it's a policy at...
You had a legit conversation on Twitter with T-Mobile, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, you see my Twitter. I'm not gonna screen share, but if you want to look it up, it's there, it's public.
It's
BS. I don't know if you want to see the side. You know, it's funny, I just Googled it, and I saw the same problem. Now, this person, I mean, it's on a forum, but they're saying the same issue. And he had to talk to higher-ups at T-Mobile. Their argument was that they want to deter sales abroad, even though AT&T does this, like no other service does this. Now, this I don't believe is true. This person is saying that even if you buy it in an Apple store, when you connect it to T-Mobile, it'll get locked, even though you bought
it. That is true. That's true. So I went straight to I went to T-Mobile. They told me what was the word. I sat in my phone for almost two hours talking to people about trying to get this changed. When I finally came to the, after talking to three people and figuring out that they're not going to budge on this, I went to the mall and went to the AT&T store. And then right after that, I went to the Apple store and asked the guy. He said, They don't sell unlocked versions of the phone right away, and so again, this is a deal they've negotiated with the carriers, in that they promise that they won't sell unlocked phones until the carriers have a chance to move their product. I haven't seen the contract. Nobody's shared that with me, but I'm positive that's the case, is that they've agreed that they won't sell unlocked phones until probably 3 to 6 months after it's been released.
I really hope you call 93.7 tomorrow, and only Connecticut people will understand this. But I really hope I listen to 93.7 tomorrow and I hear you on there complaining about this. That would make
No. All right. I'll put it in writing. Let's move on.
Yeah. Rant over. All right, we got one more topic to talk about today before we wrap up.
Yeah, yep. Kindle. There's new Kindles.
No, not that one.
Okay. Next.
Go ahead, Sean.
So Valve had a trio of announcements this week. They actually, their third announcement is going to come tomorrow. But on I believe on Monday they announced SteamOS, and on Wednesday they announced the Steam Boxes. So SteamOS is essentially a Linux-based operating system. They haven't given too many details about it, but essentially it'll run Steam in big picture mode, and it's basically this whole thing is their play to get Steam in the living room, and essentially PC gaming, it's almost like with the Steam Box, they're essentially making a PC console hybrid to some extent.
Yeah, and, that's a good way of putting it.
It's basically their play to get into the living room, and there's the rumor is that on Friday they're going to announce a controller. The controller could be interesting because they've been doing a lot of experimental stuff, but we really won't know until tomorrow. But yeah, the big thing is SteamOS getting into the living room, and I think Steam is one of those things that when it first came out, there was a huge backlash. Everybody hated it, and then it slowly became an extremely important player, and now everybody loves it, and it is PC gaming. Like, that is, it's them and pretty much good old games. Good old games, granted, they have a tiny fraction of the market, but I feel like those are the only two.
Don't forget the Mac store.
Origin has, like, five games, too.
Yeah, sorry. Origin's obviously a big one, too, because EA has, you know, a big portfolio. But I guess Steam is just, it's the platform that really pushed the way through. The interesting things about SteamOS, the positive thing is with this OS, I mean, you'll go right into Steam. You won't have to switch. And I think one downside to having a computer, like a lot of people say, hey, why don't I just get Steam on my PC and just plug it into my HDMI port? As silly as it sounds, it's not as usable as a console where...
That's what I have, though.
You do. And a lot of people do it, and I've done it before, but it's never as easy as...
Yeah, it's not mainstream enough to just plug and play and go...
Yeah, like, I mean, what do you do when you get bumped to the desktop? You could have the controller mapped to your mouse so you could go around, but it's still...
I have a wireless mouse next to me.
You could, but all that stuff...
No, I hear what you're saying. People are not as weird as me.
I want to get into that, too, because...
Let me ask you...
How weird Rob is?
Is the Steam Box going to be running Linux or just the Steam OS?
The Steam OS is a skin of Linux.
Right, so I mean, like, can you do other things in it or just do these games?
No, I don't think... I think it's going to be a Linux distribution that's going to be Steam.
Okay.
I don't think you'll be able
Big question I have is that you have to convince developers to make their games to run on a Linux-based system.
Yeah, and so this is what you, Rob and I were talking about a little bit on Tuesday afternoon, and it's you know, Tuesday happened and then Wednesday happened, and the article that I suspected had to come out came out, which is NVIDIA has relented and said they will start working on. And AMD said this too, but NVIDIA was a harder nut to crack. They will start making drivers for Linux, you know? And so
They already do, but
the gamble was, can Steam get developers, like Rob was saying, to make games? But a lot of games already run on Linux. Not every game, obviously, but a lot of games do. Wow. But then... But the other issue is, for the games that don't, they don't because of driver issues.
Well,
so if they can get drivers for the devices, I think, you know, they have a good chance of making this work.
So there are two pieces to this. So there's the software developer side and the hardware side. So to start with the software side, getting people to develop for Linux, I think. The key thing that you have to differentiate is that these people, even though it'll work on Linux, they're not going to sell it as we're going develop it for Linux. They're going to say, develop it for SteamOS. When people make Android apps, nobody says we're making a Linux app, even though Android is based off Linux. So if you see it as that idea, I think it's a lot more plausible in that you say, can you make a Steam game as well? And then they might think, okay, I mean, granted, you know, it's still Linux, but I think it changes the dynamic in that prior to this, your argument was, hey, make it for Ubuntu, which very few people use. Like, it's just that it's market share and backing. And their report, they haven't said who, but they've said they've gotten, I mean, definitely all the Valve games will be on there, which is a pretty big library, but they've said they've gotten AAA publishers on board to do it. And, I mean, if they do it, they can do it. If anyone can do it, it's Valve. They're the only ones who can really pull this off. But it's still, like you said, a huge gamble because, I mean, yeah, Linux has more and more games. All the Humble Bundles are on Linux, or a lot of them are, and it's growing, but it's still not. I mean, even OS X doesn't have close to the game support that Windows does. So it's hard enough for developers to make a Windows game to get them to do all these other platforms. It won't be super.
They'll just make they'll make Half-Life an exclusive to SteamOS.
Dude, if they ever did that, oh man,
hate it so much.
That would be crazy. That would be.
But
I don't know.
You know, I think one of the issues is though, it's harder to pirate games when it's on Steam, right? It's hard to pirate a Steam version of a game. You can pirate the game because it's released on PC in general, but it's not easily done, you know, to pirate the game on Steam. So I think that's what they're trying to sell as well for developers, that, yeah, you can develop for something that's not a console and something that is open source, because if ultimately it's going to be sold through our store, which is controlled and has DRM. So...
Which is funny, because Microsoft tried to do that, and everybody
and
knew
that's,
their shit.
That's why Gabe Newell is doing this whole thing, right? Because he got pissed off that Microsoft has an app store, and they're going to be selling stuff. And so, I, you know, earlier we talked about that kind of innovator's dilemma with Nokia and BlackBerry just being too slow to start changing their behavior, and talking about how Microsoft is... maybe not too slow, but slower than people would prefer and maybe would be comfortable with. I think this is right where Valve should be. They're jumping ahead of the curve, and they're trying to push into new territory before it becomes super obvious to everybody that, oh, they should have done this a while ago. You know, I think for people who follow this stuff, that, you know, the gamers and the tech people, they can put the dots together and say, this is a good move. But for the average person, this is just going to come out of left field. But I think it's right where...
I mean, I think it's going to depend on a lot of things. The most intriguing part of this is that it's going to be an upgradable system, which is something that I wanted to see in next-gen consoles back when we talked about this months ago. That's really intriguing to me. Obviously, you know, whatever games they get is going to be a big thing. I think price point is going to be a big thing. I mean, how is this going to operate? Like, you're not going to have... Is this going to be streaming from another PC, or are you going to be downloading the games to this console?
It's going to be a full... I mean, well, okay, so there are a lot of pieces to this that we have to put together, but the Steam boxes are going to be full computers, as far as I know. I don't think it's going to be a streaming solution. But one thing they decided, initially there were thoughts that there was going to be one Steam box, so essentially a console. But it's not going to work like that. There's going to be multiple types. So the idea, to some degree, is by opening up the platform, making it open source and the spec or whatever they're going to do with it, you know, there'll be super expensive versions, there'll be cheap versions. The hope is that they'll have different kinds.
It's going to be you know, IBM compatible versus Apple all over again. Apple was locked down, proprietary from the ground up, and, you know, all the software, hardware was developed in-house. And then IBM compatibles were, you know, Windows, and you could spec them any way you wanted. Now that it's shifted to Microsoft and Xbone and Sony and PlayStation are the Apple in the analogy, and the Steam OS and Steam boxes are the PCs in the analogy here.
What do you think about the timing of this? I mean, so you're probably going to expect to see this next year, like late next year, right?
It would be cool if they had done it for Christmas, but...
I think it's smart that they're not releasing it in the same window as the two major consoles.
You have that, like, booster window, right? You have the holidays and then, what, like, early spring is another big time for games, right? Mm-hmm. So, if they can get it out by early spring, I think...
Well, one thing a lot of people have talked about is so Steam is privately owned, so they kind of do things whenever they really want to do things.
That's a good
point. Not that they don't have PR, but they don't have it like a larger company would. And in some ways, they're dumber because of it. Not that they don't know these obvious things, but because of that, they may not have as big of a well-aligned business strategy as some might. So the thing is, from what I understand, they've been talking about this for a while. They've always wanted somebody to do it, and then no one really did. So then they decided, okay, I guess we have to do it. This whole bringing a console, a PC into the living room. One thing I think brings an interesting wrinkle to this, and I think it was announced today, was I don't know if you heard about AMD Mantle. So AMD announced, so one big advantage that consoles have over PCs is that PCs have to develop with I don't know if I'm using the right terminology, but like higher level APIs. They use DirectX or OpenGL, and PC games have to account for a wide variety of computers. They have to do, you know, AMD chips, NVIDIA chips, Intel chips, all kinds of stuff. The advantage on a console is that not only do they only have to do one type of machine, they can do what they call direct to metal. They can program it for that. And that's where you can see games like Grand Theft Auto V on literally garbage hardware. Now, what AMD announced, I believe it was today, was that they're releasing an API where you can program direct to metal on their products. And that's interesting because if they decide to put that in a Steam box, then you're taking away the huge advantage that consoles have. And actually, John Carmack tweeted about it, and he said this could create a lot of tension between Sony, Microsoft, and AMD, because, as you know, AMD got the CPU deal. So they're making the CPU for both both Sony, Microsoft, and they could be making a Steam box. Like, if they're at parity... and with a SteamOS box, you can upgrade it. You can definitely get a better GPU. And the bigger thing is you can always be cutting edge. And when I say that, I mean, you know, Microsoft and Sony had to have been building this for a while. They had to put these pieces at least a year ago. So no matter what, they're not using the new chip. Like, you know, if they were using Intel chips, they wouldn't be using Haswell because they couldn't. So it'd be interesting if they get direct to metal. I mean, if you get optimization like consoles get, you could see, and you strip away all the fat that Windows adds on. They've already shown in a number of ways that actually Linux games, Steam games on Linux are faster than their Windows counterparts. I mean, it could be interesting if you can get better performance.
Yeah, that's the advantage that PCs always had, is that they're more cutting edge. You can get more FPS. You can get, you know, than a console once it's a year old, you know, and the hardware catches up on the consumer side for PCs. But, that's an interesting argument. I think the trick is going to be making it easy enough and mainstream enough, because they still, at the end of the day, they're talking about a consumer product that belongs in the living room. And once you take it off of your computer desk, people expect tech to just work. You know, it's got to be really dead simple. That's why, like, a lot of smartphones didn't really take off until, you know, Apple didn't invent the smartphone, but they made it dead simple that everybody could use it. And then once Android followed suit and used that kind of tile icons and so forth, that's when you saw smartphones blow up. You know, so it's a matter of ease of use and cost, and that's when consumers get. That's when it becomes mainstream in the consumer space.
I think Valve could do that, though. They're
pretty good software. I think they can. It's just,
they got to get the games too.
What?
The games is a big thing too.
Well, they already essentially have the games. They have this is another complicating thing. I mean, they definitely don't have all games. Obviously, they don't have Blizzard games, they don't have EA games.
Yeah.
Now, and even aside from that, one advantage the PC had, besides the graphics thing, I don't think it doesn't always become a big enough differentiator, but what they had is that keyboard and mouse. StarCraft, you can't play on a console. You just can't. It doesn't work. MMOs, you can't... Well, okay, that's a lie. You definitely can play on a console, but they have to adapt it. But for a while, that was their domain. So I don't think Steam's going to do it on a keyboard and mouse. I think they're going to go controller. So...
So what's the controller look like? Everybody, real quick, around the horn, 1 minute, what do you think the controller looks like?
I don't think it's going to be any different.
No?
I think it's going to be pretty standard.
Okay. Sean? Or
I'm going to be cop-out answer. I do think it's going to be different. I don't know what it's going to be, though, because they specifically talked about how they had teams working on crazy things for it. Either that or none of it worked out and they're just going
to
do it normal.
But at the end of the day, all these games are mapped out to traditional console. I mean, the ones that you can use controllers for, they're typically mapped out to pretty traditional ones.
But if they're forward thinking, I mean, yeah, how many games were mapped to work on the iPad? Like, if you can sell a product, if you can make the use case for it and you can get people to buy it, people will adapt for it. I mean, but the thing is, who knows? I mean, what would be... Oculus is one thing, but I don't know how that... I don't think they're going to put Oculus in there. And but that's not an input device anyway.
Yeah. So my guess is that because it's at its base, at its core, it's a PC. It's a full-blown computer. But they want it to be a living room consumer device. They have to make some kind of a hybrid. So I'm thinking the controller with two analog sticks, a D-pad, the four buttons, the triggers, all that stuff, but something in the middle that's a touchpad, because that's going to let you basically get the controls of a mouse and a keyboard.
I mean, isn't that a PS4 controller?
No, not just a touchpad, but an actual screen. Something like a smart screen, because I can use my iPhone as a keyboard and talk to my... type in URLs on my Mac Mini, which is connected to my TV.
What do you think? What do you think the lowest cost is going to be for some?
It's going to be. I mean,
you got to talk at least $500
for the box or for the controller.
For the box.
For the box.
I hope the controller's not $500.
Well, there's that Nvidia Shield that's effectively the screen on it. I think probably about $500 is the price range they're going to be looking at.
So I mean, you're putting it right in the same category as PS4 and Xbox anyway.
Yeah. So $500 for the machine, but you can upgrade it, mm-hmm. and you know what games library it has and the backing, and I think the controller probably. I know I'm being a little crazy, but might as well be bold in my predictions, right? And we'll find out tomorrow. I think it's going to have a touch screen on it. So that they can put up a keyboard, a virtual keyboard, or other virtual controls, but it will have like the traditional D-pad. So it's going to look something like the Wii U controller, but hopefully more ergonomic than that.
I'm hoping they bring back the Jaguar keyboard. I don't know, like, remember that? Like 60 buttons in the middle. They're like, yeah, this makes sense.
Let's yeah.
It's actually a keyboard that you suspend from your neck, and it just sits in front of you.
The guitar. No, so you know what I think is crazy, just to finish it off? I feel like this is the first console cycle, and let's just assume Steam Box is a console, where all the consoles are going to be the exact same. They're all running on the same chips. Yep. They're all doing the same. Yeah. They all have the same games. I mean, I guess Steam Box is different sets, but it's like, I've never seen a situation where there's so much at parity.
With that said, I mean, there's still a lot of opportunity for differentiation through software and through ecosystem, because you look at it, for the last 7 years, Macs have been running on the same hardware as PCs. And I would say in the last 7 years, Macs have gotten even better and more unique than they had been previously.
That's true.
So, it's all about developers.
yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, this will do it for this week. Once again, I'm Rob Steller, I'm Josiah Hills, and Sean Thomas joining with me.
All three of us.
We have a website, believe it or not. It does exist.
Look,
Whether it's been updated or not. Yeah, that's the CB, in case you couldn't figure it out, because we're called the Unwind. So we are part of Commentist Block. Commentistblock.com. You can find all of our old episodes. Eventually, we will have some articles and other reviews and things up there. And, yeah, so join us again next week on Thursday around 8 o'clock, and we will talk more tech and video games. Thanks.
Good night.